Chapter 9. A Morning in Market Basing.
Ah, well, said Mrs. Copley, as she bustled out of the room. Another day, that's what I always say when I wake up.
Another day, thought Tuppence, sipping strong black tea.
I wonder if I'm making an idiot of myself. Could be. Wish I had Tommy here to talk to. Last night muddled me.
Before she left her room, Tuppence had made entries in her notebook on the various facts and names that she had heard the night before, which she had been far too tired to do when she went up to bed. Melodramatic stories of the past, containing perhaps grains of truth here and there, but mostly hearsay, malice, gossip, romantic imagination.
Really, thought Tuppence,
I'm beginning to know the love lives of a quantity of people right back to the 18th century, I think. But what does it all amount to? And what am I looking for? I don't even know any longer. The awful thing is that I've got involved, and I can't leave off. Having a shrewd suspicion that the first thing she might be getting involved with was Miss Bly, whom Tuppence recognized as the overall menace of Sutton Chancellor, she circumvented all kind offers of help by driving off to Market Basing post-haste, only pausing when the car was accosted by Miss Bly with shrill cries, to explain to that lady that she had an urgent appointment. When would she be back? Tuppence was vague. Would she care to lunch? Very kind of Miss Bly, but Tuppence was afraid.
At tea, then, 4:30. I'll expect you.
It was almost a royal command. Tuppence smiled, nodded, let in the clutch, and drove on. Possibly, Tuppence thought, if she got anything interesting out of the house agents in Market Basing, Nellie Bly might provide additional, useful information. She was the kind of woman who prided herself on knowing all about everyone. The snag was that she would be determined to know all about Tuppence. Possibly by this afternoon, Tuppence would have recovered sufficiently to be once more her own inventive self.
Remember Mrs. Blenkinsop, said Tuppence,
edging round a sharp corner and squeezing into a hedge to avoid being annihilated by a frolicsome tractor of immense bulk. Arrived in Market Basing, she put the car in a parking lot in the main square and went into the post office and entered a vacant telephone box. The voice of Albert answered, using his usual response, a single, "Hello?" uttered in a suspicious voice.
"Listen, Albert, I'll be home tomorrow, in time for dinner anyway, perhaps earlier. Mr. Beresford will be back too, unless he rings up. Get us something chicken, I think."
"Right, madam. Where are you?"
But Tuppence had rung off. The life of Market Basing seemed centred in its important main square. Tuppence had consulted a classified directory before leaving the post office, and three out of the four house and estate agents were situated in the square, the fourth in something called George Street. Tuppence scribbled down the names and went out to look for them. She started with Messrs. Lovebody and Slicker, which appeared to be the most imposing. A girl with spots received her.
"I want to make some inquiries about a house."
The girl received this news without interest. Tuppence might have been inquiring about some rare animal.
"Oh, I don't know, I'm sure," said the girl,
looking round to ascertain if there were one of her colleagues to whom she could pass Tuppence on.
"A house," said Tuppence. "You are house agents, aren't you?"
"House agents and auctioneers. The Cranberry Court auction's on Wednesday, if that's what you're interested in. Catalogue's 2 shillings.
"I'm not interested in auctions. I want to ask about a house.
Furnished?"
"Unfurnished. To buy or rent?"
Spots brightened a little.
"Oh, I think you'd better see Mr. Slicker."
Tuppence was all for seeing Mr. Slicker, and was presently seated in a small office opposite a tweed-suited young man in horsey checks, who began turning over a large number of particulars of desirable residences, murmuring comments to himself. 8 Munville Road. Architect built 3-bed. American kitchen. Oh, no, that's gone. Amabel de Lodge, picturesque residence, 4 acres, reduced price for quick sale. Tuppence interrupted him forcefully.
"I have seen a house I like the look of in Sutton Chancellor, or rather near Sutton Chancellor, by a canal."
"Sutton Chancellor?" Mr. Slicker looked doubtful.
"Oh, I don't think we have any property there on our books at present. What name?"
"Well, he doesn't seem to have any written up. Possibly Waterside or Rivermead. Once called Bridge House, I gather," said Tuppence.
The house is in two parts. One half is let, but the tenant there could not tell me anything about the other half, which fronts on the canal, and which is the one in which I am interested. It appears to be unoccupied. Mr. Slicker said distantly that he was afraid he couldn't help her, but condescended to supply the information that perhaps Messrs. Blodgett and Burgess might do so. By the tone in his voice, the clerk seemed to imply this Messrs. Blodgett and Burgess were a very inferior firm. Tuppence transferred herself to Messrs. Blodgett and Burgess, who were on the opposite side of the square, and whose premises closely resembled those of Messrs. Lovebody and Slicker, the same kind of sale bills and forthcoming auctions in their rather grimy windows. Their front door had recently been repainted a rather bilious shade of green, if that was accounted to be a merit. The reception arrangements were equally discouraging, and Tuppence was given over to a Mr. Sprigg, an elderly man of apparently despondent disposition. Once more, Tuppence retailed her wants and requirements. Mr. Sprigg admitted to being aware of the existence of the residence in question, but was not helpful, or, as far as it seemed, much interested.
"Oh, it's not on the market, I'm afraid. The owner doesn't want to sell."
"Who is the owner?"
"Oh, really, I doubt if I know. It has changed hands rather frequently. There was a rumour at one moment of a compulsory purchase order."
"What did any local government want it for?"
"Oh, really, Mrs.
He glanced down at Tuppence's name, jotted down on his blotter.
"Mrs. Beresford, if you could tell me the answer to that question, you would be wiser than most victims are these days. The ways of local councils and planning societies are always shrouded in mystery. The rear portion of the house had a few necessary repairs done to it, and was let at an exceedingly low rent to a Mr. and Mrs. Perry. As to the actual owners of the property, the gentleman in question lives abroad and seems to have lost interest in the place. I imagine there was some question of a minor inheriting, and it was administered by executors. Some small legal difficulties arose. The law tends to be expensive, Mrs. Beresford. I fancy the owner is quite content for the house to fall down. No repairs are done except to the portion the Perrys inhabit. The actual land, of course, might always prove valuable in the future. The repair of derelict houses is seldom profitable. If you're interested in a property of that kind, I'm sure we could offer you something far more worth your while. What, if I may ask, is there which especially appealed to you in this property?"
"Well, I like the look of it," said Tuppence. "It's a very pretty house. I saw it first from the train."
"Oh, I see."
Mr. Sprigg masked as best he could an expression of "the foolishness of women is incredible," and said soothingly, "Well, I should really forget all about it if I were you."
"I suppose you could write and ask the owners if they would be prepared to sell, or if you would give me their, or his address."
"We will get into communication with the owner's solicitors if you insist, but I can't hold out much hope."
"I suppose one always has to go through solicitors for everything nowadays." Tuppence sounded both foolish and fretful. "And lawyers are always so slow over everything."
"Ah, yes, the law is prolific of delays."
"And so are banks, just as bad."
"Banks?"
Mr. Sprigg sounded a little startled. "Well, so many people give you a bank as an address. That's tiresome, too."
Yes, as you say. But people are so restless these days and move about so much, living abroad and all that."
He opened a desk drawer.
"Now, I have a property here, Crossgates, 2 miles from Market Basing, very good condition, a nice garden."
Tuppence rose to her feet. "No, thank you." She bade Mr. Sprigg a firm goodbye and went out into the square. She paid a brief visit to the third establishment, which seemed to be mainly preoccupied with sales of cattle, chicken farms, and general farms in a derelict condition. She paid a final visit to Messrs. Roberts and Wiley in George Street, which seemed to be a small but pushing business, anxious to oblige, but generally uninterested and ignorant of Sutton Chancellor, and anxious to sell residences as yet only half-built at what seemed ridiculously exorbitant sums. An illustration of one made Tuppence shudder. The eager young man, seeing his possible client firm in departure, admitted unwillingly that such a place as Sutton Chancellor did exist.
"Sutton Chancellor, you mentioned. Better try Blodgett and Burgess in the square. They handle some property thereabouts. But it's all in very poor condition, run down."
"There's a pretty house near there by a canal bridge. I saw it from the train. Why does nobody want to live there?
Oh, I know the place. This, riverbank, and oh, you wouldn't get anyone to live in it. Got a reputation as haunted.
Oh, you mean ghosts?
So they say, lots of tales about it, noises at night and groans. If you ask me, it's Death Watch Beetle.
Oh dear, said Tuppence.
It looks to me so nice and isolated. Oh, much too isolated, most people would say. Floods in winter, think of that.
I see there's a lot to think about, said Tuppence bitterly. She murmured to herself as she sent her steps towards the Lamb and Flag, at which she proposed to fortify herself with lunch.
A lot to think about. Floods, Death Watch Beetle, ghosts clanking chains, absentee owners and landlords, solicitors, banks, a house that nobody wants or loves, except perhaps me. Oh well, what I want now is food.
The food at the Lamb and Flag was good and plentiful. Hearty food for farmers rather than phony French menus for tourists passing through. Thick, savoury soup, leg of pork and apple sauce, Stilton cheese, or plums and custard if you preferred it, which Tuppence didn't. After a desultory stroll round, Tuppence retrieved her car and started back to Sutton Chancellor, unable to feel that her morning had been fruitful. As she turned the last corner and Sutton Chancellor Church came into view, Tuppence saw the vicar emerging from the churchyard. He walked rather wearily. Tuppence drew up by him.
"Are you still looking for that grave?" she asked.
The vicar had one hand at the small of his back.
"Oh, dear," he said. "My eyesight is not very good. So many of the inscriptions are nearly erased. My back troubles me, too. So many of these stones lie flat on the ground. Really, when I bend over sometimes, I fear that I shall never get up again."
Oh, I shouldn't do it any more, said Tuppence. If you've looked in the parish register and all that, you've done all you can.
Well, I know, but the poor fellow seems so keen, so earnest. I'm quite sure that it's all wasted labour. However, I really felt it was my duty. I've still got a short stretch I haven't done. Over there, from beyond the yew tree to the far wall, although most of the stones are 18th century. But I should like to feel I had finished my task properly. Then I could not reproach myself. However, I shall leave it until tomorrow.
Quite right, said Tuppence. You mustn't do too much in one day. I tell you what, she added, after I've had a cup of tea with Miss Bly, I'll go and have a look myself. From the yew tree to the wall, did you say?
Oh, but I couldn't possibly ask you.
Oh, that's all right. I shall quite like to do it. I think it's very interesting prowling round in a churchyard. You know, the older inscriptions give you a sort of picture of the people who lived here, and all that sort of thing. I shall quite enjoy it, I really shall. Do go back home and rest.
Well, of course, I really have to do something about my sermon this evening, it's quite true. You are a very kind friend, I'm sure, a very kind friend.
He beamed at her and departed into the vicarage. Tuppence glanced at her watch. She stopped at Miss Bly's house.
Might as well get it over, thought Tuppence.
The front door was open and Miss Bly was just carrying a plate of fresh-baked scones across the hall into the sitting-room.
Oh, so there you are, dear Mrs. Beresford. I'm so pleased to see you. Tea's quite ready. The kettle is on. I've only got to fill up the teapot. I hope you did all the shopping you wanted, she added,
looking in a rather marked manner at the painfully evident empty shopping bag hanging on Tuppence's arm.
Well, I didn't have much luck, really, said Tuppence,
putting as good a face on it as she could.
You know how it is sometimes, just one of those days when people just haven't got the particular colour or the particular kind of thing you want. But I always enjoy looking round a new place, even if it isn't a very interesting one.
A whistling kettle let forth a strident shriek for attention, and Miss Bly shot back into the kitchen to attend to it, scattering a batch of letters waiting for the post on the hall table. Tuppence stooped and retrieved them, noticing as she put them back on the table that the topmost one was addressed to a Mrs. York, Rose Trellis Court, for elderly ladies, at an address in Cumberland.
Really? Thought Tuppence. I'm beginning to feel as if the whole of the country is full of nothing but homes for the elderly. I suppose in next to no time, Tommy and I will be living in one.
Only the other day, some would-be kind and helpful friend had written to recommend a very nice address in Devon. Married couples, mostly retired service people, quite good cooking, you brought your own furniture and personal belongings. Miss Bly reappeared with the teapot, and the two ladies sat down to tea. Miss Bly's conversation was of a less melodramatic and juicy nature than that of Mrs. Copley, and was concerned more with the procuring of information than of giving it. Tuppence murmured vaguely of past years of service abroad, the domestic difficulties of life in England, gave details of a married son and a married daughter, both with children, and gently steered the conversation to the activities of Miss Bly in Sutton Chancellor, which were numerous, the Women's Institute, guides, scouts, the Conservative Ladies' Union, lectures, Greek art, jam-making, flower arrangement, the sketching club, the Friends of Archaeology, the vicar's health, the necessity of making him take care of himself, his absent-mindedness, unfortunate differences of opinion between church wardens. Tuppence praised the scones, thanked her hostess for her hospitality, and rose to go. "You are so wonderfully energetic, Miss Bly," she said. "How you manage to do all you do, I cannot imagine. I must confess that after a day's excursion and shopping, I like just a nice little rest on my bed. Just half an hour or so of shut-eye, a very comfortable bed, too. I must thank you very much for recommending me to Mrs. Copley. A most reliable woman, though of course she talks too much. Oh, I found all her local tales most entertaining. Half the time she doesn't know what she's talking about. Are you staying here for long? Oh, no, I'm going home tomorrow. I'm disappointed at not having heard of any suitable little property. I had hopes of that very picturesque house by the canal. Well, you're well out of that. It's in a very poor state of repair. Absentee landlords. It's a disgrace. I couldn't even find out who it belongs to. I expect you know. You seem to know everything here. I've never taken much interest in that house. It's always changing hands. One can't keep pace. The Perrys live in half of it. The other half just goes to rack and ruin. Tuppence said goodbye again and drove back to Mrs. Copley's. The house was quiet and apparently empty. Tuppence went up to her bedroom, deposited her empty shopping bag, washed her face and powdered her nose, tiptoed out of the house again, looking up and down the street, then leaving her car where it was, she walked swiftly round the corner and took a footpath through the field behind the village, which eventually led to a stile into the churchyard. Tuppence went over the stile into the churchyard, peaceful in the evening sun, and began to examine the tombstones as she had promised. She had not really had any ulterior motive in doing so. There was nothing here she hoped to discover. It was really just kindness on her part. The elderly vicar was rather a dear, and she would like him to feel that his conscience was entirely satisfied. She had brought a notebook and a pencil with her in case there was anything of interest to note down for him. She presumed she was merely to look for a gravestone that might have been put up commemorating the death of some child of the required age. Most of the graves here were of an older date. They were not very interesting, not old enough to be quaint or to have touching or tender inscriptions. They were mostly of fairly elderly people. Yet she lingered a little as she went along, making mental pictures in her mind. Jane Elwood departed this life, January the 6th, aged 45. William Marle departed this life, January the 5th, deeply regretted. Mary Treves, 5 years old, March the 14th, 1835. Well, that was too far back. In thy presence is the fullness of joy. Lucky little Mary Treves. She had almost reached the far wall now. The graves here were neglected and overgrown. Nobody seemed to care about this bit of the cemetery. Many of the stones were no longer upright, but lay about on the ground. The wall here was damaged and crumbling. In places, it had been broken down. Being right behind the church, it could not be seen from the road, and no doubt children came here to do what damage they could. Tuppence bent over one of the stone slabs. The original lettering was worn away and unreadable, but heaving it up sideways, Tuppence saw some coarsely scrawled letters and words, also by now partly overgrown. She stopped to trace them with a forefinger, and got a word here and there. Whoever offend. One of these little ones, millstone, 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 and below, in uneven cutting by an amateur hand, here lies Lily Waters. Tuppence drew a deep breath. She was conscious of a shadow behind her, but before she could turn her head, something hit her on the back of her head, and she fell forwards onto the tombstone, into pain and darkness. Book 3. Missing, a Wife. Chapter 10. A Conference, and After.
"Well, Beresford,"
said Major General Sir Josiah Penn, KMG, CB, DSO, speaking with the weight appropriate to the impressive stream of letters after his name.
"Well, what do you think of all that yakety-yak?"
Tommy gathered by that remark that old Josh, as he was irreverently spoken of behind his back, was not impressed with the result of the course of the conferences in which they had been taking part.
"Softly, softly, catchy monkey," said Sir Josiah, going on with his remarks. "A lot of talk and nothing said. If anybody does say anything sensible now and again, about four beanstalks immediately get up and howl it down. I don't know why we come to these things. At least I do know. I know why I do. Nothing else to do. If I didn't come to these shows, I'd have to stay at home. Do you know what happens to me there? I get bullied, Beresford. Bullied by my housekeeper. Bullied by my gardener. He's an elderly Scot, and he won't so much as let me touch my own peaches. So I come along here, throw my weight about, and pretend to myself that I'm performing a useful function, ensuring the security of the country. Stuff and nonsense. What about you? You're a relatively young man. What do you come and waste your time for? Nobody will listen to you, even if you do say something worth hearing."
Tommy, faintly amused that despite his own, as he considered, advanced age, he could be regarded as a youngster by Major General Sir Josiah Penn, shook his head. The general must be, Tommy thought, considerably past 80. He was rather deaf, heavily bronchial, but he was nobody's fool.
"Oh, nothing would ever get done at all if you weren't here, sir," said Tommy. "Well, I like to think so," said the general. "I'm a toothless bulldog, but I can still bark. How's Mrs. Tommy? Haven't seen her for a long time."
Tommy replied that Tuppence was well and active.
"Oh, she was always active. Used to make me think of a dragonfly sometimes, always darting off after some apparently absurd idea of her own. Then we'd find it wasn't absurd." "Good fun," said the general, with approval. "Don't like these earnest, middle-aged women you meet nowadays. All got a cause with a capital C. And as for the girls nowadays," he shook his head, "not what they used to be when I was a young man. Pretty as a picture they used to be then. Their muslin frocks, cloche hats they used to wear at one time, do you remember? No, I suppose you'd have been at school. Had to look right down underneath the brim before you would see the girl's face. Tantalizing it was, and they knew it. I remember now, let me see. She was a relative of yours, an aunt, wasn't she? Ada Fanshawe."
"Aunt Ada?"
"Prettiest girl I ever knew."
Tommy managed to contain the surprise he felt. That his Aunt Ada could ever have been considered pretty seemed beyond belief. Old Josh was dithering on.
"Yes, pretty as a picture, sprightly too, gay, regular tease. I remember the last time I saw her. I was a subaltern just off to India. We were at a moonlight picnic on the beach. She and I wandered away together, sat on a rock looking out at the sea."
Tommy looked at him with great interest, at his double chins, his bald head, his bushy eyebrows, and his enormous paunch. He thought of Aunt Ada, of her incipient moustache, her grim smile, her iron-grey hair, her malicious glance. Time, he thought, what time does to one? He tried to visualize a handsome young subaltern and a pretty girl in the moonlight. He failed.
"Romantic,"
said Sir Josiah Penn with a deep sigh.
"Ah, yes, romantic. I would have liked to propose to her that night. But you couldn't propose if you were a subaltern, not on your pay. We'd have had to wait 5 years before we could be married. That was too long an engagement to ask any girl to agree to. Ah, well, you know how things happen. I went out to India, and it was a long time before I came home on leave. We wrote to one another for a bit, then things slacked off, as it usually happens. I never saw her again, and yet, you know, I never quite forgot her. Often thought of her. I remember I nearly wrote to her once, years later. I'd heard she was in the neighbourhood where I was staying with some people. I thought I'd go and see her, ask if I could call. Then I thought to myself, don't be a damn fool. She probably looks quite different by now. I heard a chap mention her some years later, said she was one of the ugliest women he'd ever seen. I could hardly believe it when I heard him say that. But I think now perhaps I was lucky I never did see her again. What's she doing now? Alive still?
No, she died about 2 or 3 weeks ago, as a matter of fact, said Tommy.
Did she really? Did she really? Yes, I suppose she'd be, what, now? She'd be, what, 75, 76? A bit older than that, perhaps.
She was 80, said Tommy.
Fancy now. Dark-haired, lively Ada. Huh. Now, where did she die? Was she in a nursing home, or did she live with a companion, or she never married, did she?
No, said Tommy. She never married. She was in an old lady's home. Rather a nice one, as a matter of fact. Sunny Ridge, it's called.
Yeah, yes, I've heard of that. Sunny Ridge. Someone my sister knew was there, I believe. A Mrs. What was her name? A Mrs. Carstairs? Ever come across her?
No, I didn't come across anyone much there. One just used to go and visit one's own particular relative.
Difficult business, too, I think. I mean, one never knows what to say to them.
Aunt Ada was particularly difficult, said Tommy. She was a Tartar, you know.
Oh, she would be,
the General chuckled.
She could be a regular little devil when she liked when she was a girl.
He sighed.
Devilish business getting old. One of my sister's friends used to get fancies, poor thing. Used to say she'd killed somebody.
Oh, good Lord, said Tommy. Had she?
Oh, I don't suppose so. Nobody seems to think she had. I suppose, said the General, considering the idea thoughtfully, I suppose she might have, you know. If you go about saying things like that quite cheerfully, nobody would believe you, would they? Entertaining thought there, isn't it?
Who did she think she'd killed?
Well, blessed if I know. Husband, perhaps? Don't know who he was or what he was like. She was a widow when we first came to know her. Well, he added with a sigh, sorry to hear about Ada. Didn't see it in the paper. If I had, I'd have sent flowers or something. A bunch of rosebuds or something of that kind. That's what girls used to wear on their evening dresses. Bunch of rosebuds on the shoulder of an evening dress. Very pretty it was. Now, I remember Ada had an evening dress, sort of hydrangea colour, sort of mauvey blue, and she had pink rosebuds on it. She gave me one once. Well, they weren't real, of course. Artificial. I kept it for a long time. Years. I know, he added, catching Tommy's eye. Makes you laugh to think of it, doesn't it? I tell you, my boy, when you get really old and gaga like I am, you get sentimental again. Well, I suppose I'd better toddle off and go back to the last act of this ridiculous show. Best regards to Mrs. T when you get home.
In the train the next day, Tommy thought back over this conversation, smiling to himself and trying again to picture his redoubtable aunt and the fierce Major General in their young days. I must tell Tuppence this. It'll make her laugh, said Tommy. I wonder what Tuppence has been doing while I've been away. He smiled to himself. The faithful Albert opened the front door with a beaming smile of welcome.
Oh, glad to see you back, sir.
I'm glad to be back. Tommy surrendered his suitcase. Where's Mrs. Beresford?
We're not back yet, sir.
What do you mean she's away?
Been away 3 or 4 days, sir.
But she'll be back for dinner. She rang up yesterday and said so.
What's she up to, Albert?
I couldn't say, sir.
She took the car, but she took a lot of railway guides as well. She might be anywhere, as you might say.
You might indeed, said Tommy with feeling. John O'Groats or Land's End. And probably missed the connection at Little Dithon on the Marsh on the way back. God bless British Railways. She rang up yesterday, you say. Did she say where she was ringing from?
She didn't say.
What time yesterday was this?
Yesterday morning, before lunch.
Just said everything was all right. She wasn't quite sure of what time she'd get home, but she thought she'd be back well before dinner, and suggested a chicken.
That do you all right, sir?
Yes, said Tommy, regarding his watch. But you'll have to make it pretty quickly now.
I'll hold the chicken back, said Albert.
Tommy grinned. That's right, he said. Catch it by the tail. How have you been, Albert? All well at home?
Oh, I had a scare of measles, but that's all right. Doctor says it's only strawberry rash.
Oh, good, said Tommy. He went upstairs, whistling a tune to himself. He went into the bathroom, shaved and washed, strode from there into the bedroom, and looked around him. It had that curious look of disoccupancy some bedrooms put on when their owner is away. Its atmosphere was cold and unfriendly. Everything was scrupulously tidy and scrupulously clean. Tommy had the depressed feeling that a faithful dog might have had. Looking round him, he thought it was as though Tuppence had never been. No spilled powder, no book cast down with its back splayed out.
"Sir?"
It was Albert standing in the doorway.
"Well?"
"I'm getting worried about the chicken." "Oh, damn the chicken," said Tommy. "You seem to have that chicken on your nerves."
"Well, I took it as you and she wouldn't be later than 8. Not later than 8 sitting down, I mean."
"Well, I should have thought so too," said Tommy, glancing at his wristwatch. "Good Lord, is it nearly 9:25?
"Yes, it is, sir."
"And the chicken?" "Oh, come on," said Tommy. "You get that chicken out of the oven, and you and I'll eat it between us. Served up and right. Getting back well before dinner, indeed."
"Well, of course, some people do eat dinner late," said Albert. "I went to Spain once, and believe me, you couldn't get a meal before 10 o'clock.
10 p.m., I ask you."
"Heathens."
"All right," said Tommy absent-mindedly. "By the way, have you no idea where she has been all this time?"
"Well, you mean the missus?"
"Oh, I don't know, sir. Rushing around, I'd say. Her first idea was going to places by train, as far as I can make out. She was always looking in ABCs and timetables and things."
"Well," said Tommy, "we all have our ways of amusing ourselves, I suppose. Hers seems to have been railway travel. I wonder where she is, all the same.
Sitting in the ladies' waiting room at Little Dither on the Marsh, as likely as not."
"Well, she knew as you was coming home today, though, didn't she, sir?" said Albert.
"She'll get here somehow, sure to."
Tommy perceived that he was being offered loyal allegiance. He and Albert were linked together in expressing disapprobation of a Tuppence who, in the course of her flirtations with British Railways, was neglecting to come home in time to give a returning husband his proper welcome. Albert went away to release the chicken from its possible fate of cremation in the oven. Tommy, who had been about to follow him, stopped and looked towards the mantelpiece. He walked slowly to it and looked at the picture that hung there. Funny, her being so sure that she had seen that particular house before. Tommy felt quite certain that he hadn't seen it. Anyway, it was quite an ordinary house. There must be plenty of houses like that. He stretched up as far as he could towards it, and then, still not able to get a good view, unhooked it and took it close to the electric lamp. A quiet, gentle house. There was the artist's signature. The name began with a B, though he couldn't make out exactly what the name was. Bosworth? Bouchier? He'd get a magnifying glass and look at it more closely. A merry chime of cowbells came from the hall. Albert had highly approved of the Swiss cowbells that Tommy and Tuppence had brought back sometime or other from Grindelwald. He was something of a virtuoso on them. Dinner was served. Tommy went into the dining room. It was odd, he thought, that Tuppence hadn't turned up by now. Even if she had had a puncture, which seemed probable, he rather wondered that she hadn't rung up to explain or excuse her delay. "She might know that I'd worry," said Tommy to himself. Not, of course, that he did worry. Not about Tuppence. Tuppence was always all right. Albert contradicted his mood. "Hope she hasn't had an accident," he remarked, presenting Tommy with a dish of cabbage and shaking his head gloomily. "Oh, take that away, you know I hate cabbage," said Tommy. "Why should she have had an accident? It's only 9:30 now." "Or being on the road is plain murder nowadays," said Albert. "Anyone might have an accident." The telephone bell rang. "That's her," said Albert. Hastily reposing the dish of cabbage on the sideboard, he hurried out of the room. Tommy rose, abandoning his plate of chicken, and followed Albert. He was just saying, "Here, I'll take it," when Albert spoke. "Yes, sir?"
Yes, Mr. Beresford is at home."
"He's here now."
He turned his head to Tommy.
"It's a Dr. Murray for you, sir."
"Dr. Murray?" Tommy thought for a moment. The name seemed familiar, but for the moment he couldn't remember who Dr. Murray was. If Tuppence had had an accident. And then with a sigh of relief he remembered that Dr. Murray had been the doctor who attended the old ladies at Sunny Ridge. Something perhaps to do with Aunt Ada's funeral forms. True child of his time, Tommy immediately assumed that it must be a question of some form or other, something he ought to have signed, or Dr. Murray ought to have signed.
"Hello," he said. "Beresford here."
"Oh, I'm glad to catch you. You remember me, I hope. I attended your aunt, Miss Fanshawe.
Oh, yes, of course I remember. What can I do?
I really wanted to have a word or two with you sometime. I don't know if we can arrange a meeting, perhaps, in town one day?
Oh, I expect so, yes, quite easily, but is it something you can't say over the phone?
I'd rather not say it over the telephone. There's no immediate hurry. I won't pretend there is, but I should like to have a chat with you.
Nothing wrong, said Tommy, and wondered why he put it that way. Why should there be anything wrong?
Not really. I may be making a mountain out of a molehill, probably am. But there have been some rather curious developments at Sunny Ridge.
Nothing to do with Mrs. Lancaster, is it? Asked Tommy.
Mrs. Lancaster?
The doctor seemed surprised.
No, she left some time ago. In fact, before your aunt died, this is something quite different.
I've been away. I only just got back. May I ring you up tomorrow morning? We could fix something then.
All right, I'll give you my telephone number. I shall be at my surgery until 10 a.m.
Bad news? Asked Albert as Tommy returned to the dining room.
No, of course it isn't bad news. I thought perhaps the missus...
She's all right, said Tommy. She always is. Probably gone herring off after some wildcat clue or other. You know what she's like. I'm not going to worry any more. Take away this plate of chicken. You've been keeping it hot in the oven and it's inedible. Bring me some coffee and then I'm going to bed.
There will probably be a letter tomorrow, delayed in the post, you know what the posts are like, or there'll be a wire from her or she'll ring up.
But there was no letter next day. No telephone call. No wire. Albert eyed Tommy, opened his mouth and shut it again several times, judging quite rightly that gloomy predictions on his part would not be welcomed. At last Tommy had pity on him. He swallowed a last mouthful of toast and marmalade, washed it down with coffee, and spoke.
All right, Albert. I'll say it first. Where is she? What's happened to her? And what are we going to do about it?
Get on to the police, sir.
I'm not sure. You see,
Tommy paused.
Well, if she's had an accident, she's got her driving license on her, and plenty of identification papers. Hospitals are very prompt at reporting these things, and getting in touch with relatives, all that. I don't want to be precipitate. She mightn't want it. You've no idea, no idea at all, Albert, where she was going. Nothing she said, no particular place or county, not a mention of some name.
Albert shook his head.
What was she feeling like? Pleased? Excited? Unhappy? Worried?
Albert's response was immediate.
Pleased as punch. Burst him with it.
Well, like a terrier off on the trail, said Tommy.
That's right, sir. You know how she gets.
Onto something. Now, I wonder, Tommy paused in consideration. Something had turned up, and, as he had just said to Albert, Tuppence had rushed off like a terrier on the scent. The day before yesterday, she had rung up to announce her return. Why, then, hadn't she returned? Perhaps at this moment, thought Tommy, she's sitting somewhere, telling lies to people so hard that she can't think of anything else. If she were engrossed in pursuit, she would be extremely annoyed if he, Tommy, were to rush off to the police bleating like a sheep that his wife had disappeared. He could hear Tuppence saying, "How you could be so fatuous as to do such a thing? I can look after myself perfectly. You want to know that by this time." But could she look after herself? One was never quite sure where Tuppence's imagination could take her. Into danger? There hadn't so far been any evidence of danger in this business. Except, as aforesaid, in Tuppence's imagination. If he were to go to the police, saying his wife had not returned home, as she announced she was going to do, the police would sit there, looking tactful, though possibly grinning inwardly, and would then, presumably, still in a tactful way, ask what men friends his wife had got. "I'll find her myself," declared Tommy. "She's somewhere. Whether it's north, south, east, or west, I've no idea. And she was a silly cuckoo not to leave word when she rang up where she was."
"A gang's got her, perhaps," said Albert.
"Oh, be your age, Albert. You've outgrown that sort of stuff years ago. What are you going to do, sir?"
"I'm going to London," said Tommy, glancing at the clock. "First, I'm going to have lunch at my club with Dr. Murray, who rang me up last night and who's got something to say to me about my late deceased aunt's affairs. I might possibly get a useful hint from him. After all, this business started at Sunny Ridge. I'm also taking that picture that's hanging over our bedroom mantelpiece up there."
"Well, you mean you're taking it to Scotland Yard?"
No, said Tommy. I'm taking it to Bond Street. Chapter 11 Bond Street and Dr. Murray. Tommy jumped out of a taxi, paid the driver, and leaned back into the cab to take out a rather clumsily done-up parcel, which was clearly a picture. Tucking as much as he could of it under his arm, he entered the New Athenian Galleries, one of the longest established and most important picture galleries in London. Tommy was not a great patron of the arts, but he had come to the New Athenian because he had a friend who officiated there. Officiated was the only word to use because the air of sympathetic interest, the hushed voice, the pleasurable smile, all seemed highly ecclesiastical. A fair-haired young man detached himself and came forward, his face lighting up with a smile of recognition. "Hello, Tommy," he said. "Haven't seen you for a long time. What's that you've got under your arm? Don't tell me you've been taking to painting pictures in your old age. A lot of people do. Results usually deplorable." "I doubt if creative art was ever my long suit," said Tommy, "though I must admit I found myself strongly attracted the other day by a small book telling in the most simple terms how a child of 5 could learn to paint in watercolours. God help us if you're going to take to that. Grandma Moses in reverse. To tell you the truth, Robert, I merely want to appeal to your expert knowledge of pictures. I want your opinion on this." Deftly, Robert took the picture from Tommy and skillfully removed its clumsy wrappings with the expertise of a man accustomed to handle the parceling up and deparceling of all different sized works of art. He took the picture and set it on a chair, peered into it to look at it, and then withdrew 5 or 6 steps away. He turned his gaze towards Tommy. "Well," he said, "what about it? What do you want to know? Do you want to sell it, is that it?" No, said Tommy, "I don't want to sell it, Robert. I want to know about it. To begin with, I want to know who painted it." "Actually," said Robert, "if you had wanted to sell it, it would be quite saleable nowadays. It wouldn't have been 10 years ago, but Boscawen's just coming into fashion again." "Boscawen?" Tommy looked at him inquiringly. "Is that the name of the artist? I saw it was signed with something beginning with B, but I couldn't read the name." "Oh, it's Boscawen, all right. Very popular painter about 25 years ago. Sold well, had plenty of shows. People bought him, all right. Technically, a very good painter. Then, in the usual cycle of events, he went out of fashion. Finally, hardly any demand at all for his works. But lately he's had a revival. He, Stitchwort, and Fondella, they're all coming up." "Boscawen," repeated Tommy. "B-O-S-C-O-W-A-N, said Robert obligingly. "Is he still painting?" "No, he's dead. Died some years ago. Quite an old chap by then. 65, I think, when he died. Quite a prolific painter, you know. A lot of his canvases about. Actually, we're thinking of having a show of him here in about 4 or 5 months' time. We ought to do well over it, I think. Why are you so interested in him?" "Oh, it'd be too long a story to tell you," said Tommy. "One of these days I'll ask you out to lunch and give you the doings from the beginning. It's a long, complicated, and rather an idiotic story. All I wanted to know is all about this Boscawen, and if you happen to know by any chance where this house is that's represented here." "Well, I couldn't tell you the last for a moment. It's the sort of thing he did paint, you know, small country houses in rather isolated spots usually. Sometimes a farmhouse, sometimes just a cow or two around, sometimes a farm cart. But if so, in the far distance. Quiet rural scenes, nothing sketchy or messy. Sometimes the surface looks almost like enamel. It was a peculiar technique and people liked it. A good many of the things he painted were in France, Normandy mostly, churches. I've got one picture of his here now. Wait a minute, I'll get it for you." He went to the head of the staircase and shouted down to someone below. Presently, he came back holding a small canvas which he propped on another chair. "There you are," he said. "Church in Normandy." "Yes," said Tommy, "I see. Same sort of thing. My wife says nobody ever lived in that house, other one I brought in." "I see now what she meant. I don't see that anybody was attending service in that church or ever will. Perhaps your wife's got something. Quiet, peaceful dwellings with no human occupancy. He didn't often paint people, you know.
Sometimes there's a figure or two in the landscape, and more often not. In a way, I think that gives them their special charm. A sort of isolationist feeling. It was as though he removed all the human beings, and the peace of the countryside was all the better without them. Come to think of it, that's maybe why the general taste has swung round to him. Too many people nowadays, too many cars, too many noises on the road, too much noise and bustle. Peace. Perfect peace. Leave it all to nature. Yes, I shouldn't wonder. What sort of man was he? I didn't know him personally, before my time. Pleased with himself, by all accounts. Thought he was a better painter than he was, probably. Put on a bit of side. Kindly. Quite likeable. Eye for the girls. And you've no idea where this particular piece of countryside exists. It is England, I suppose. Well, I should think so, yes. Do you want me to find out for you? Could you? Probably the best thing to do would be to ask his wife, his widow, rather. He married Emma Wing, the sculptor. Well known, not very productive. Does quite powerful work. You could go and ask her. She lives in Hampstead. I can give you the address. We've been corresponding with her a good deal lately over the question of this show of her husband's work we're doing. We're having a few of her smaller pieces of sculpture as well. I'll get the address for you. He went to the desk, turned over a ledger, scrawled something on a card, and brought it back. There you are, Tommy, he said. I don't know what the deep, dark mystery is. Always been a man of mystery, haven't you? It's a nice representation of Boscawen's work you've got there. We might like to use it for the show. I'll send you a line to remind you nearer the time. You don't know a Mrs. Lancaster, do you? Well, I can't think of one offhand. Is she an artist or something of the kind? No, I don't think so. She's just an old lady living for the last few years in an old lady's home. She comes into it because this picture belonged to her until she gave it away to an aunt of mine. Well, I can't say the name means anything to me. Better go and talk to Mrs. Boscawen. What's she like? Oh, she was a good bit younger than he was, I should say. Quite a personality. He nodded his head once or twice. Yes, quite a personality. You'll find that out, I expect. He took the picture, handed it down the staircase with instructions to someone below to do it up again. Nice for you having so many myrmidons at your beck and call, said Tommy. He looked round him, noticing his surroundings for the first time. Oh, what's this you've got here now? He said with distaste. Paul Jagorowsky. Interesting young Slav, said to produce all his works under the influence of drugs. Don't you like him? Tommy concentrated his gaze on a big string bag, which seemed to have enmeshed itself in a metallic green field full of distorted cows. Oh, frankly, no. Philistine, said Robert. Come out and have a bite of lunch. I can't, I've got a meeting with a doctor at my club. Not ill, are you? I'm in the best of health. My blood pressure is so good that it disappoints every doctor to whom I submit it. Well, then what do you want to see a doctor for? Oh, said Tommy cheerfully. I've just got to see a doctor about a body. Thanks for your help. Goodbye. Tommy greeted Dr. Murray with some curiosity. He presumed it was some formal matter to do with Aunt Ada's decease. But why on earth Dr. Murray would not at least mention the subject of his visit over the telephone, Tommy couldn't imagine. I'm afraid I'm a little late, said Dr. Murray, shaking hands. But the traffic was pretty bad, and I wasn't exactly sure of the locality. I don't know this part of London very well. Well, too bad you had to come all the way here, said Tommy. I could have met you somewhere more convenient, you know. Oh, you've time on your hands, then, just now? Just at the moment, yes. I've been away for the last week. Yes, I believe someone told me so when I rang up. Tommy indicated a chair, suggested refreshment, placed cigarettes and matches by Dr. Murray's side. When the two men had established themselves comfortably, Dr. Murray opened the conversation. I'm sure I've aroused your curiosity, he said, but as a matter of fact, we're in a spot of trouble at Sunny Ridge. It's a difficult and perplexing matter, and in one way, it's nothing to do with you. I've no earthly right to trouble you with it, but there's just an off chance that you might know something which would help me. Well, of course, I'll do anything I can. Something to do with my aunt? Miss Fanshawe? Not directly, no, but in a way she does come into it. I can speak to you in confidence, can't I, Mr. Beresford? Oh, yes, certainly. As a matter of fact, I was talking the other day to a mutual friend of ours. He was telling me a few things about you.
I gather that in the last war you had rather a delicate assignment.
Oh, I wouldn't put it quite as seriously as that, said Tommy, in his most non-committal manner.
Oh, no, I quite realize that it's not a thing to be talked about.
I don't think that really matters nowadays. It's a good long time since the war. My wife and I were younger then. Anyway, it's nothing to do with that that I wanted to speak to you about. But at least I feel that I can speak frankly to you, that I can trust you not to repeat what I'm saying now, though it's possible that it all may have to come out later.
A spot of trouble at Sunny Ridge, you say?
Yes, not very long ago, one of our patients died. Mrs. Moody. I don't know if you ever met her or if your aunt ever talked about her.
Mrs. Moody, Tommy reflected.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, not so far as I can remember.
She was not one of our older patients. She was still on the right side of 70, and she was not seriously ill in any way. It was just a case of a woman with no near relatives and no one to look after her in the domestic line. She fell into the category of what I often call to myself a flutterer, women who more and more resemble hens as they grow older. They cluck. They forget things. They run themselves into difficulties, and they worry. They get themselves wrought up about nothing at all. There is very little the matter with them. They're not, strictly speaking, mentally disturbed.
But they just cluck, Tommy suggested.
As you say, Mrs. Moody clucked. She caused the nurses a fair amount of trouble, although they were quite fond of her. She had a habit of forgetting when she'd had her meals, making a fuss because no dinner had been served, when, as a matter of fact, she had actually just eaten a very good dinner.
Oh, said Tommy, enlightened, Mrs. Coco.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry, said Tommy. It's a name my wife and I had for her. She was yelling for Nurse Jane one day when we passed along the passage and saying she hadn't had her cocoa. Rather a nice-looking, scatty little woman. But it made us both laugh, and we fell into the habit of calling her Mrs. Coco. And so she's died.
Well, I wasn't particularly surprised when the death happened, said Dr. Murray. To be able to prophesy with any exactitude when elderly women will die is practically impossible. Women whose health is seriously affected, who one feels as a result of physical examination will hardly last the year out, sometimes are good for another 10 years. They have a tenacious hold on life which mere physical disability will not quench. There are other people whose health is reasonably good and who may, one thinks, make old bones. They, on the other hand, catch bronchitis or flu, seem unable to have the stamina to recuperate from it, and die with surprising ease. So, as I say, as a medical attendant to an elderly lady's home, I am not surprised when what might be called a fairly unexpected death occurs. This case of Mrs. Moody, however, was somewhat different. She died in her sleep without having exhibited any sign of illness, and I could not help feeling that, in my opinion, her death was unexpected. I will use the phrase that has always intrigued me in Shakespeare's play Macbeth. I have always wondered what Macbeth meant when he said of his wife, "She should have died hereafter."
"Yes, I remember wondering once myself what Shakespeare was getting at," said Tommy. "I forget whose production it was and who was playing Macbeth, but there was a strong suggestion in that particular production, and Macbeth certainly played it in a way to suggest that he was hinting to the medical attendant that Lady Macbeth would be better out of the way. Presumably the medical attendant took the hint. It was then that Macbeth, feeling safe after his wife's death, feeling that she could no longer damage him by her indiscretions, or her rapidly failing mind, expresses his genuine affection and grief for her. She should have died hereafter.
Exactly, said Dr. Murray. It is what I felt about Mrs. Moody. I felt that she should have died hereafter, not just 3 weeks ago, of no apparent cause.
Tommy did not reply. He merely looked at the doctor inquiringly.
Medical men have certain problems. If you're puzzled over the cause of a patient's death, there is only one sure way to tell, by a post-mortem. Post-mortems are not appreciated by relatives of the deceased, but if a doctor demands a post-mortem and the result is, as it perfectly well may be, a case of natural causes or some disease or malady which does not always give outward signs or symptoms, then the doctor's career can be quite seriously affected by his having made a questionable diagnosis.
I can see that it must have been difficult.
The relatives in question are distant cousins, so I took it upon myself to get their consent, as it was a matter of medical interest to know the cause of death,
When a patient dies in her sleep, it is advisable to add to one's medical knowledge. I wrapped it up a good bit, mind you. Didn't make it too formal. Luckily, they couldn't care less. I felt very relieved in mind. Once the autopsy had been performed, and if all was well, I could give a death certificate without a qualm. Anyone can die of what is amateurishly called heart failure from one of several different causes. Actually, Mrs. Moody's heart was in really very good shape for her age. She suffered from arthritis and rheumatism and occasional trouble with her liver, but none of these things seemed to accord with her passing away in her sleep. Dr. Murray came to a stop. Tommy opened his lips and then shut them again. The doctor nodded. Yes, Mr. Beresford, you can see where I'm tending. Death has resulted from an overdose of morphine. Good Lord. Tommy stared. Yes, it seemed quite incredible, but there was no getting away from the analysis. The question was, how was that morphine administered? She was not on morphia. She was not a patient who suffered pain. There were three possibilities. She might have taken it by accident. Unlikely. She might have got hold of some other patient's medicine by mistake, but that again is not particularly likely. Patients are not entrusted with supplies of morphia, and we do not accept drug addicts who might have a supply of such things in their possession. It could have been deliberate suicide, but I should be very slow to accept that. Mrs. Moody, though a warrior, was of a perfectly cheerful disposition, and I am quite sure had never given a thought to ending her life. The third possibility is that a fatal overdose was deliberately administered to her. But by whom? And why? Naturally, there are supplies of morphia and other drugs which Miss Packard, as a registered hospital nurse and matron, is perfectly entitled to have in her possession, and which she keeps in a locked cupboard. In such cases as sciatica or rheumatoid arthritis, there can be such severe and desperate pain that morphia is occasionally administered. We had hoped that we might come across some circumstances in which Mrs. Moody had a dangerous amount of morphia administered to her by mistake, or which she herself took under the delusion that it was a cure for indigestion or insomnia. We have not been able to find any such circumstances possible. The next thing we have done, at Miss Packard's suggestion, and I agreed with her, is to look carefully at the records of such deaths as have taken place at Sunny Ridge in the last 2 years. There have not been many of them, I'm glad to say. I think 7 in all, which is a pretty fair average for people of that age group. 2 deaths of bronchitis, perfectly straightforward. 2 of flu, always a possible killer during the winter months, owing to the slight resistance offered by frail elderly women. And 3 others. He paused and said, Mr. Beresford, I am not satisfied about those 3 others. Certainly not about 2 of them. They were perfectly probable. They were not unexpected, but I will go as far as saying that they were unlikely. They are not cases that, on reflection and research, I am entirely satisfied about. One has to accept the possibility that, unlikely as it seems, there is someone at Sunny Ridge who is, possibly for mental reasons, a killer. An entirely unsuspected killer. There was silence for some moments. Tommy gave a sigh. I don't doubt what you've told me, he said. But all the same, frankly, it seems unbelievable. These things, surely they can't happen. Oh, yes, said Dr. Murray grimly. They happen, all right. You go over some of the pathological cases. A woman who took on domestic service. She worked as a cook in various households. She was a nice, kind, pleasant-seeming woman, gave her employers faithful service, cooked well, enjoyed being with them. Yet, sooner or later, things happened. Usually a plate of sandwiches, sometimes picnic food. For no apparent motive, arsenic was added. 2 or 3 poisoned sandwiches among the rest. Apparently sheer chance dictated who took and ate them. There seemed no personal venom. Sometimes no tragedy happened. The same woman was 3 or 4 months in a situation, and there was no trace of illness. Nothing. Then she left to do another job. And in that next job, within 3 weeks, 2 of the family died after eating bacon for breakfast. The fact that all these things happened in different parts of England and at irregular intervals made it some time before the police got on her track.
She used a different name, of course, each time. But there are so many pleasant, capable, middle-aged women who can cook, it was hard to find out which particular woman it was.
Why did she do it?
I don't think anybody has ever really known. There have been several different theories, especially, of course, by psychologists. She was a somewhat religious woman, and it seems possible that some form of religious insanity made her feel that she had a divine command to rid the world of certain people. But it does not seem that she herself had borne them any personal animus. Then there was the French woman, Jeanne Gabron, who was called the Angel of Mercy. She was so upset when her neighbors had ill children, she hurried to nurse those children, sat devotedly at their bedside. There again it was some time before people discovered that the children she nursed never recovered. Instead, they all died. And why? It is true that when she was young, her own child died. She appeared to be prostrated with grief. Perhaps that was the cause of her career of crime. If her child died, so should the children of other women. Or it may be, as some thought, that her own child was one of the victims.
You're giving me the chills down my spine, said Tommy.
I'm taking the most melodramatic examples, said the doctor. It may be something much simpler than that. You remember in the case of Armstrong, anyone who had in any way offended him or insulted him, or indeed, if he even thought anyone had insulted him, that person was quickly asked to tea and given arsenic sandwiches. A sort of intensified touchiness. His first crimes were obviously mere crimes for personal advantage. Inheriting of money. The removal of a wife so that he could marry another woman. And then there was Nurse Warriner, who kept a home for elderly people. They made over what means they had to her and were guaranteed a comfortable old age until death came. But death did not delay very long. There, too, it was morphia that was administered. A very kindly woman, but with no scruples. She regarded herself, I believe, as a benefactor. You've no idea, if your surmise about these deaths is true, who it could be.
No, there seems no pointer of any kind. Taking the view that the killer is probably insane, insanity is a very difficult thing to recognize in some of its manifestations. Is it somebody, shall we say, who dislikes elderly people, who had been injured or has had her life ruined, or so she thinks, by somebody elderly? Or is it possibly someone who has her own ideas of mercy killing, and thinks that everyone over 60 years of age should be kindly exterminated? It could be anyone, of course. A patient, a member of staff, a nurse, a domestic worker. I've discussed this at great length with Millicent Packard, who runs the place. She is a highly competent woman, shrewd and businesslike, with keen supervision both of the guests there and of her own staff. She insists that she has no suspicion and no clue whatever, and I'm sure that is perfectly true. But why come to me? What can I do? Your aunt, Miss Fanshawe, was a resident there for some years. She was a woman of very considerable mental capacity, though she often pretended otherwise. She had unconventional ways of amusing herself by putting on an appearance of senility, but she was actually very much all there. What I want you to try and do, Mr. Beresford, is to think hard. You and your wife, too. Is there anything you can remember that Miss Fanshawe ever said or hinted that might give us a clue? Something she had seen or noticed, something that someone had told her, something that she herself had thought peculiar. Old ladies see and notice a lot, and a really shrewd one like Miss Fanshawe would know a surprising amount of what went on in a place like Sunny Ridge. These old ladies are not busy, you see. They have all the time in the world to look around them and make deductions, and even jump to conclusions that may seem fantastic, but are sometimes, surprisingly, entirely correct.
Tommy shook his head. Well, I know what you mean, but I can't remember anything of that kind.
Your wife's away from home, I gather. You don't think she might remember something that hadn't struck you?
Well, I'll ask her, but I doubt it. He hesitated, then made up his mind.
Look here, there was something that worried my wife. About one of the old ladies. A Mrs. Lancaster.
Oh, Mrs. Lancaster, yes?
My wife's got it into her head that Mrs. Lancaster has been taken away by some so-called relations very suddenly.
As a matter of fact, Mrs. Lancaster gave a picture to my aunt as a present, and my wife felt that she ought to offer to return the picture to Mrs. Lancaster. So she tried to get in touch with her to know if Mrs. Lancaster would like the picture returned to her. Well, that was very thoughtful of Mrs. Beresford, I'm sure. Only she found it very hard to get in touch with her. She got the address of the hotel where they were supposed to be staying, Mrs. Lancaster and her relations, but nobody of that name had been staying there, or had booked rooms there. Oh, well, that was rather odd. Yes, Tuppence thought it was rather odd, too. They had left no other forwarding address at Sunny Ridge. In fact, we've made several attempts to get in touch with Mrs. Lancaster, or with this Mrs. Johnson, I think the name was, but have been quite unable to get in touch with them. There was a solicitor who, I believe, paid all the bills and made all the arrangements with Miss Packard, and we got into communication with him, but he could only give me the address of a bank. Banks, said Tommy dryly, don't give you any information. Not if they've been told not to by their clients, I agree. My wife wrote to Mrs. Lancaster, care of the bank, and also to Mrs. Johnson, but she's never had any reply. Well, that seems a little unusual. Still, people don't always answer letters. They may have gone abroad. Quite so, it didn't worry me, but it has worried my wife. She seems convinced that something has happened to Mrs. Lancaster. In fact, during the time I was away from home, she said she was going to investigate further. I don't know what exactly she meant to do. Perhaps see the hotel personally, or the bank, or try the solicitor. Anyway, she was going to try and get a little more information. Dr. Murray looked at him politely, but with a trace of patient boredom in his manner. Why did she think exactly? She thinks that Mrs. Lancaster is in danger of some kind, even that something may have happened to her. The doctor raised his eyebrows. Oh, really? I should hardly think. This may seem quite idiotic to you, said Tommy, but you see, my wife rang up saying she would be back yesterday evening, and she didn't arrive. She said definitely that she was coming back? Yes. She knew I was coming home, you see, from this conference business, so she rang up to let our man Albert know that she'd be back to dinner. And that seems to you an unlikely thing for her to do? Said Dr. Murray. He was now looking at Tommy with some interest. Yes, said Tommy. It's very unlike Tuppence. If she'd been delayed or changed her plans, she would have rung up again or sent a telegram. And you're worried about her? Yes, I am, said Tommy. Have you consulted the police? No, said Tommy. What did the police think? It's not as though I had any reason to believe that she's in trouble or danger or anything of that kind. I mean, if she'd had an accident or was in a hospital, anything like that, somebody would communicate with me soon enough, wouldn't they? I should say so, yes. If she had some means of identification on her, or she'd have her driving license on her, probably letters and various other things. Dr. Murray frowned. Tommy went on in a rush. And now you come along and bring up all this business of Sunny Ridge, people who've died when they oughtn't to have died. Supposing this old bean got onto something, saw something, or suspected something, and began chattering about it. She'd have to be silenced in some way, so she was whisked out of it quickly and taken off to some place or other where she wouldn't be traced. I can't help feeling that the whole thing ties up somehow. It's odd. It's certainly odd. What do you propose to do next? I'm going to do a bit of searching myself. Try these solicitors first. They may be quite all right, but I'd like to have a look at them and draw my own conclusions.